Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, KBIA's weekly show, where people and ideas meet. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Across the country, about 17% of young people under 20 are considered obese. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Here in Missouri, some analysts estimate that nearly a third of children ages 10 to 17 are obese or overweight. And those numbers are on the rise. One report estimates that obesity rates could top 60% by 2030 if the trend continues. So what's contributing to this upward trend? What could parents do to ensure that their children have healthy eating habits? And what roles do schools play? Today at Intersection, we're talking about childhood obesity and how to prevent it. Joining me in studio are several panelists. Dr. Anish Tosh is the director of the University of Missouri Children's Hospital's Adolescent Diabetes and Obesity Program. That program, which also goes by the acronym ADOBE, works with children to help develop healthy eating habits. Kayla Audison is a dietitian with that same program, the Adolescent Diabetes and Obesity Program. Steve Ball is an associate professor with the MU Department of Nutrition and Exercise Physiology. He's also a state fitness specialist with MU Extension. And joining us by phone is Lena Fulham. She's the Director of Nutrition Services for Columbia Public Schools. And we'd like to hear from you and our audience as well. What could parents do to ensure that their children have healthy eating habits? We'd like to hear your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Well, I just want to start out the conversation by asking a pretty broad question. What is contributing to this rise in obesity rates? Dr. Tosh, do you want to take that first?
Sure. We do know that there's a part that's genetic, and so we know that when there are overweight parents, many times there is an increased likelihood of children being overweight. But we also know the parts that we can control include decrease in exercise over time and also increase in calories over time. And so it's a pretty close correlation. If the exercise goes down, calorie consumption goes up, weight seems to go up, it's pretty clear.
Okay, and what would you recommend in terms, well, I guess it varies between various young people, but typically what's like a healthy caloric intake?
I'll let Kayla answer, she's our expert.
I mean, in general, I would say about 2,000 calories, but that varies on the individual and how active they are and their age.
Okay. Well, Lena Fulham, I want to bring you into this conversation. What is the Columbia Public School District doing to ensure that children have access to healthy food?
Well, we've been doing quite a few things, actually, in the last few years and before that. Before I even came here, we've always had salad bars at all of our schools. And the reason I mention that is because produce, and increased produce and encouraging produce in children is a great way to supplant higher calorie foods with lower calorie foods that are nutrient dense. So I always like to harp on our salad bars that we have in all of our schools. We are under actually a very regimented new set of regulations, which I am very behind, and it encourages legume consumption, color in your food, and whole grain consumption, and also calorie restriction and making sure that saturated fat and fat content of meals is in check.
And
so
who's
behind the new things that we're doing?
Who's behind that dietary regimen? Those new
USDA.
Guidelines?
USDA is our governing agency. They're the ones that basically, you know, tell us what we're supposed to be doing with our meals in terms of nutrient content.
Okay. And by when do schools have to be compliant with that?
This year.
Okay. So how does Columbia Public Schools, how do their offerings compare with other schools in the state or even, you know, the county?
Well, not really sure. Since we write menus for Columbia Public Schools, we don't really, you know what else is going on out there as far in terms of other schools.
Okay. Well, what would you recommend, Steve, in terms of ensuring that kids are active and healthy in schools?
Right. Well, the recommendation for physical activity for kids, the government recommendation, 60 minutes a day. Unfortunately, that's probably not enough. That would be the minimum that we would recommend that kids get once a week or something like that. They really need up to several hours a day of physical activity, and we've relied on the PE teacher as the means to get kids fit, and that model hasn't worked. We have more overweight kids than we've ever had, so we've got to figure out how we can involve the parents and get kids active in and out of school.
Okay, and Lena, have you seen any changes, or does that assessment, I guess, how do you view it with respect to CPS?
Well, when I look at some of the habits of our, just in general, of U.S. citizens, it's again, just like Dr. Tosh said, it's an energy balance. And in this case, an energy imbalance. There's more calories going in than there are going out in exercise. And I think we're seeing a lot of that due to the changing ways that we eat in our society. I think we eat out more often. And I think, and studies have shown when you eat out, you have a tendency to eat more calories than you would if you were at home. I think we share fewer meals at the family table, and that also has shown to have a healthier impact if you are actually eating as a family on a regular basis. So there's been a shift in a lot of the things that we do as a society surrounding food and exercise.
Hmm. Well, does Columbia Public Schools do anything to encourage that type of communal eating among families?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the hardest pieces for my department to get at is to outreach to parents to, you know, let them know some tips about how to, you know, and what to be looking for. But we advertise it on our website, you know, ways to, you know, keep a healthy child. We have our new menus is what it's called on the website. It tells how many calories everything is. It has several panelists every month that give information about nutrition and exercise. And it's very high. I mean, it's very informational.
Okay. Well, if we can go back to actual school lunches and what's being offered to students, it sounds like you are off. There is a much healthier, kids are offered much healthier foods, but how do you actually ensure that they eat it?
Oh, that's another tough one. Well, one of the things that we absolutely have to do in order to make sure that a child is at least getting it on their tray is we are forcing them to take fruits or vegetables on their tray every meal. And that alone doesn't ensure that they're going to eat it for, you know, but it does at least increase the likelihood that they're going to. And I think that's the thinking of USDA is if it's not on their tray, they're not going to eat it. But if it's on their tray, it increases the likelihood at which they will eat it.
Okay. And Dr. Tosh or Kayla, have you worked with school districts or other schools in the past? Would you have any, do you have a sense of what's worked with regards to getting kids to eat healthier?
And I actually haven't worked with many school districts.
Not directly, but as Lena, your radio guest, mentioned already, it is true. I mean, it is supported by evidence that by just exposing a child to a fruit or vegetable, having it nearby, they will oftentimes try it. And just like it was mentioned, if it's not around, they won't eat it, and of course, we'll go for the unhealthier option. So it is supported by evidence, medical research, that it's just good to expose children to foods that we would consider healthier. And many times they'll surprise you and actually will try it. Sometimes our kids are come from homes where that's not offered, and if we can offer in the school system and they like the fruit or vegetable that they're trying, then that's a consider that a win.
Okay. Well, I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tongakar. Today, we're talking about childhood obesity. Joining me in studio are Dr. Anish Tosh and Kayla Audison from the Adolescent Diabetes and Obesity Program at the University of Missouri's Children's Hospital. Also at our table is Steve Ball. He's the associate professor in the MU Department of Nutrition and Exercise Physiology. And joining us by phone is Elena Fulham. She's the director of nutrition services for Columbia Public Schools. And for you in our audience, what role should schools play in ensuring that children eat healthy foods? We'd love to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at @intersectkbia. We'd also like to remind you that Intersection is presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2, online at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2, online at kbia.org. Well, I just, Lena, I'm kind of curious. Since the new guidelines have been released, how have students been reacting? Well, both students and parents, how have they been reacting to the new menus? And have you seen any surprises in terms of how receptive people are?
Actually, a few surprises did come out. I think our parents are very happy because what we're doing and what we didn't do before, unfortunately, is tooting our horn in the respect that we're putting this information on our menus rather than just, saying, it's pizza. We're making sure that parents know that it's actually whole grain pizza. So we have a kid-friendly item that's on a whole grain crust. We only have so much room, so we can't say low-fat cheese, those kinds of things. Now, I would say students hate to read that kind of thing. They think, oh, less of this or more of that might mean less taste. So, we get kind of a mixed bag. I do feel like there have been some students who have actually started eating with us, and this is just anecdotal information that I've gotten from parents that, oh, my child never ate, in the cafeteria before, and now they're very interested in doing so when they would like for me to put money on their account. So I've heard that more often than I expected to. So I think that's good. We had to make an effort to advertise to students in the cafeteria because at first it was confusing some of the different things we were forcing them to do, like take fruit or vegetable or certain number of components. Those kinds of things can be confusing to parents and students. And so educating our families is important as well.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like it could be kind of a daunting task, right? I mean, you're exposing children to these healthier foods that they might not have been exposed to in the past.
Right. I
was wondering also, though, how are these changes being funded? Are they more or less? So, for example, are the new school lunches more or less expensive than previous ones?
They're more expensive, and we're being forced by USDA to also increase our prices. We get a reimbursement of free meals and reduced meals, and then, of course, we get a small stipend for paid meals. And if we're not getting at least as much as a free meal in terms of how much we are charging a paid family for a meal, then we have to raise that price every year until we actually meet that point. So USDA is requiring that we do increase the price of meals because they know that more fruits and vegetables that we have to purchase in order to meet this new demand, it will be quite a bit more expensive. Whole grain products are more expensive. Some reduced fat things are more expensive. So they were aware that that was going to happen, and they are forcing us to raise prices.
Okay, and Dr. Tosh and Kayla, in working with people, do you find that this economic issue might be an obstacle for them in terms of accessing healthier food?
It tends to come up, but then again, there is a cost for purchasing soda and other things as well. So I think you just have to make the comparison help parents especially kind of make decisions that are in the best long-term interest of their children. And I think when we talk about that, there is a cost for soda, there is a cost for eating out, and then you put it in those type of terms, it may make the purchasing fruits and vegetables and a more palatable option for families when you kind of go over the other costs that they're actually spending right now on the things they're spending their money on right now.
Okay, and could you go into some of the adverse health effects of obesity and just poor diet?
Sure. Of course, what we worry most about, one of the worst long-term consequences is development of diabetes, specifically type 2 diabetes. We used to call that adult onset diabetes not too long ago. In fact, in my medical school training, that's how I learned it. However, we have many children now, so people under the age of 18 who are now developing type 2 diabetes, so we no longer can call it adult onset diabetes. And that really is a long-term consequence of weight gain. That's what we worry most about long-term. Once you get diabetes, then you are at risk of other medical problems as well, heart disease, stroke, nerve problems, vision problems, kidney problems. So you get this really bad disease, diabetes, and at least even further disease. So we are really trying, our ultimate goal is to prevent or at least delay the onset of diabetes, and really that's done with what we're talking about, diet and exercise.
Okay, and we have a question from our chat room. Could you expand on offering healthy tips for kids who don't eat anything? I'll often set out healthy options, but the kids aren't biting at it. Bribing also doesn't really help. So I guess what would you tell parents in that situation?
Sure. I guess I'll answer that one. That's what I talk about every day. So, and I think someone already mentioned this, but You know, I think kids have to be exposed to new foods and fruits and vegetables many times before they're willing to accept that new food. So continuing to offer it, being a good role model and show how good that food tastes or that fruit or vegetable tastes. I usually say with raw vegetables or fruit, if you can offer a low-fat dip with it, make it more fun, include them in the preparation or even the shopping of those fruits and vegetables, I think those things can help a lot.
Okay. And do you have anything to add to that, Lena?
Our responsibility as a school district, too, we do invest in nutrition education. We have two nutrition educators on staff who go around and actually do a hands-on integrated class for, and it's also age-appropriate for all of our students, and we just have to be invited. Our teachers have to invite us, and we go, say we're going to make a salad. We actually make a salad with the children and teach them the concepts about, why is it important to eat produce and what does that mean to us. And so there's different classes for different grade levels, and there's different amount of time. So like a kindergartner would get, say, 15-minute lesson. But what's nice about it is they get to touch it, feel it, see it, taste it, in a safe environment. This is not about lunch or breakfast. This is not about them committing a portion of their tray to something. They get to actually just taste it or just smell it. They don't even have to taste it, but it's exposure. Again, back to that idea of exposure.
Well, it sounds like it, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like there might be something more to that. In addition to exposure, it sounds like a lot of these programs are giving children options and choices in selecting what they eat. How important a component is that when teaching healthy eating habits?
Oh, I think it's very important. Studies have shown that it's just like our salad bars. I'll go back to that, that when a child gets to choose what it is they're eating, they're more apt to actually eat it. So that's one of our tools, mechanisms by which we try to encourage consumption of fruits and vegetables. We put it there, a variety of items on our salad bar every day. They get to choose what they're going to eat. And some of our, say like our fresh fruit and vegetable schools, we usually actually go out to a grant to actively have midday snacks of fruits and vegetables. Those schools, whenever I go to visit those schools, those are the ones that the children absolutely have no problem and qualms about putting fruits and vegetables on their tray. So again, that whole exposure piece, keep introducing it over and over. Don't lose heart, because children will eventually accept at least some of it, if not all of it.
Okay. Well, I know you have to run soon, but was there anything else that you wanted to add?
I think that covers it. We're trying to do our best, and it's a work in progress. Healthy foods are not always, when we're changing and evolving, and we are, our food system is changing and evolving, it's hard to find that balance of health and taste. And so we're working hard to try and find that balance for students.
Okay, well, thank you. I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tongakar. Today, we're talking about childhood obesity. Unfortunately, we're going to have to say goodbye to Lena Fulham. She's the Director of Nutrition Services for Columbia Public Schools. Lena, thank you so much for joining us today. Okay, and joining us in studio are Dr. Anish Tosh and Kayla Audison from the University of Missouri Children's Hospital's Adolescent Diabetes and Obesity Program. Also joining us in studio is Steve Ball. He's an associate professor in the MU Department of Nutrition and Exercise Physiology. And for the parents in our audience, how do you get your kids to be active? Let us know what works for you. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at @intersectkbia. Well, I guess to that point, Steve, what would you recommend to parents in terms of getting them to encourage their kids to lead more active lives?
Yeah, well, one of the logical places to start is to work with the schools, and we've had some success through a couple different programs. Jump into Action and our Active and Healthy Schools program. I always start off with this. If you think about an elementary school, think about what you see when you walk into a school. You see things on the walls about reading and writing and math, and there's art, and there's computers, and there's a media center, and there's pens and papers. What's that tell our kids? We value academics, and we should value academics, but how much of the culture and environment of a school tells our young folks that we also value physical activity, we value nutrition, we value health? So the idea behind our programming is to let's start with small changes to change the atmosphere, change the environment. We've been talking about nutrition changes here. That's one small change that we're doing in schools to let our kids know that we value what they're putting in their bodies. what else can we do? So some simple things. One of the things that we do is we help train teachers to take activity breaks during the classroom. Typically, we've relied on the physical educator, and again, that model hasn't worked. The fitness push that we've been doing for 50 years is not a good model, and so it promotes it favors the genetically gifted kids, the athletic kids, and the skilled kids, and so the overweight kids, the unathletic kids, are kind of shoved off to the side. So we need a new model. That's another topic, but. We get the classroom teachers involved. So going beyond physical education, let's train the teachers how to get kids up just for a couple of minutes to get kids moving. And I can give some examples, some fun games that teachers could use later on if we wanted to go that far into it. So that's one small thing that you might see in a school to change the culture. Another thing might be zoning the playgrounds. On an unzoned playground, an unsupervised playground, only about 30% of kids are actively engaged. To an untrained person, it looks like all kids are moving around and running, but the athletic kids are hogging the best equipment. The strong kids are dominating the weak kids. The shy kids are pushed off to the side. It's not a pleasant experience for all involved. And so we need to have take better care of that time, because the time that's dedicated to physical activity is limited. We've cut back on physical education. We've cut back on recess. So zoning the playgrounds. So we have more supervision out there, and we might, for example, have a sports zone. We might have a new game zone. We might have a walking track. We might have a low activity, kind of more of a social zone that can be used as a hook to get kids interested in more vigorous types of physical activity on a zoned playground. And we have data through our programming, but it's consistent with other research. 70% of kids are actively engaged on a zoned playground. So that's something you might see in what we call an active and healthy school. You might see the classroom activity breaks. You might see a zoned playground. You might see signs throughout the school that talk about physical activity and nutrition. We change the name of recess to activity time. We change the playground to the activity zone. We send messages out in the morning about physical activity and nutrition. We take the classroom activity breaks. You might see pedometers or step counters in an active and healthy school. These are just little things that over time can build up. And so I think the idea is, you know, we've got to tackle it from many different angles. One simple thing's not going to work. And you mentioned your question had to deal with parents, but we've got to move. School's a logical place to start, but how do we get the parents involved? And that's a difficult thing. Kids get most of their activity outside of school, believe it or not. So they get some in physical education. They get some throughout the rest of the day. But where can we make the biggest difference is probably working with parents. And so tough question to answer. How do we get the parents involved? I mean, what we have done, and it's not hugely successful, is send home newsletters about our programming. Here's what we're doing in the schools. Here are some things you can do with your kids at home. You can take a walk. You can talk about physical activity. You can get a pedometer. And we've been fortunate enough in some of our grants to actually purchase pedometers for parents and teach parents how to use these tools at home with their kids. So You're right on track. We've got to get involved in the parents and to helping kids become physically active.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of suggestions that you just listed, and I do want to explore that in greater detail, but we have a chat room comment, or a question rather. What options can parents look to if they are concerned that their kid is not eating healthy for those that won't eat anything? Also, those who seem addicted to sweets. Are there doctors that I should chat with about that? Also, are there any summer camps that might help? So it's kind of approaching it from a different perspective, children that don't really eat that much, as opposed to eating junk food. Any suggestions for that?
Well, you want me to go ahead for the kids that don't eat anything, we can't force food down a child. So again, you just have to offer and engage them with the preparation. Give them a choice, or maybe a familiar food and then a new food with that familiar food. But all you can do is really encourage and offer new foods.
Okay.
I will say one thing, Eric, and I'm not sure if this is what your chat room questioner was talking about, but we know that soda and other high-carb beverages and also high-carb snacks tend to fill children up, And if so, if that's what they're eating and drinking during their snack time, they're not going to be eating well during the actual scheduled meal times. And so a lot of what I focus on, and also Kayla, is really working on those excess carbohydrate drinks and and foods. We've found there's evidence supporting that if, at least in terms of food and dietary changes, the most the biggest impact we can make in terms of helping patients lose weight, reduce their calories, is to reduce those sugared beverages. It's not just soda. It's fruit juice, I should say. It's fruit juice. It's Kool-Aid. It's sweet tea. There's a lot of sweet tea consumption in mid-Missouri. And so by reducing sugared beverages, I think you can make a big impact in childhood obesity.
And typically, in what ways do you encourage a reduction in sugared beverages, though? Because I feel like a lot of people might know, you know, that it's not healthy for them.
We emphasize, and Kayla can kind of back me up here. I kind of want to go over kind of a simple mnemonic that we kind of go over in a clinic, but it's easy for our parents to understand, and also for other pediatricians, other healthcare providers to understand. It's the 5-3-2-1-0 plan. Five stands for a goal of five fruits and vegetables in a day. Three stands for three servings of dairy in a day, or calcium. Two stands for no more than 2 hours of screen time a day, which is actually very hard to meet. One is at least 1 hour of exercise a day, as Steve mentioned. And then zero stands for zero sugared beverages. So the goal, actually, to answer your question, is zero. It's really hard. We mentioned zero, and everyone's eyes light up in the room, patient and parents. You mean no soda? And so you have to kind of ease them into it. But really, if they can get to no sugared beverages, that our patients who've been able to meet that goal or get close to it have been the ones who are losing weight.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and a lot of the conversation has focused on, you know, teaching healthy eating habits. But what happens if you have a child that's already obese? Or is the intervention strategy different?
I think you have to make it a family-focused, especially, again, we're talking about children and adolescents. You know, they usually, typically, they're living with a parent who's making a lot of the choices for them. I think one problem we hear a lot is we want to make the diet for the child only, and it really needs to be a family-centered change. So I sometimes hear parents tell me, well, I can keep my soda, right? You just want the child to get rid of their soda. No. Everyone needs to, if you're really interested and really worried about your child's health, this needs to be a family-centered thing. We should exercise together. We should make these dietary changes together, parent and child. And again, our families where that's been able to happen are the ones where we see the children be successful.
Okay, and I think that gets to the role of parental modeling and ensuring the success of a healthy eating habit. Do you find that a lot of the parents you work with, do they practice healthy eating habits?
You know, it depends, you know, and we don't want to make judgments. I mean, I think a lot of people think they're doing the right things. And so, you know, we work with what we get.
Sure.
The fact that they're even showing up to our clinic tells us there's some buy-in. So there's probably a lot of families out there that aren't even showing up that are probably worse off. But at least the parents are and the kids come in, and there's some reason they're showing up. Someone told them, someone's concerned. So I think we have a little bit of buy-in already when they show up in our clinic. And so we're just trying to get them to make the best changes for their child.
Okay, we have one more question from our chat room. You had mentioned this earlier that, you know, high sugar beverages are terrible for you, but what are some other things that kids should not eat and avoid that are also high carb?
I mean, high carb foods, I can tell you what those are. I mean, any kind of sugar sweetened beverage, so soda, Kool-Aid, juice, Gatorade even. A lot of people think that's healthy, but that can be a problem as well. Let's see. Any kind of sweets. So candy, cookies, pie, those sorts of things are, you know, refined sugars.
Okay. Well, I think we'll have to leave that at there. We're about to take a break right now. This is Intersection, program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're taking a closer look at childhood obesity. I'm Raymond Tungekar. We'll be back after a short break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Today, we're talking about childhood obesity and ways to combat it. Joining me in studio are Dr. Anish Tosh and Kayla Audison from the University of Missouri Children's Hospital's Adolescent Diabetes and Obesity Program. Also joining our table is Steve Ball. He's an associate professor in the MU Department of Nutrition and Exercise Science, and he is also a state fitness specialist with MU Extension. And we also want to hear from you in our audience. What would you recommend that parents could do to ensure a healthy lifestyle among their children? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. So before the break, Kayla, you were talking about what foods people should avoid.
Sure.
Well, I just want to explore the opposite side of that question. What types of foods would you promote?
Okay. In general, low-calorie foods, so foods that you can eat more of that are not as calorie dense, fruits and vegetables, whole grain products, calorie-free beverages, low-fat meats, beans, legumes, that sort of thing would be encouraged, and limit the extras or the high-calorie foods.
Okay. And so when parents encourage their children to lead healthier lifestyles, is there a concern that they might go too far and perhaps stigmatize the, you know, someone being overweight or the issue?
We never want to shame our patients and their children. So I appreciate that concern. So I think it has to be done with compassion. That so we use the term health a lot. We rarely actually, at least I don't. I don't think we rarely use the term weight or, we really try to focus on health, and work with the children on improving their lifestyle so they can become healthier, and work with their parents so their family can be healthier. So, I think when the emphasis is on health, you try to reduce that likelihood of stigma. Very rarely we've had some parents who may have overdone it, but that's very rare, and we'll deal with those issues. But overall, for the most part, you know, I think if we do in a compassionate setting, the family does it together, so we're not picking on just one child who may be overweight. I think it's the chance of having a stigma is less.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of fascinated by just that role, you know, framing the message plays and ensuring that any intervention would be successful long term. Are there ways of framing the message that inadvertently results in shaming?
I mean, sure. I mean, I don't want to use the terms, but there are obviously terms that people use to criticize people who are overweight, and we all know what those are, especially as a child. I mean, one thing we'd screen for all our patients in the Adobe Clinic is for teasing and bullying, as well as for depression. So the mental health piece is actually very strong. Children who have mental health issues or maybe depressed are at higher risk of being overweight, and patients who are overweight have a higher risk of being depressed. And so it kind of goes both ways. So we definitely are very considerate of the mental health issues. And again, with bullying, and of course bullying has become more of a prominent issue in for all children in the last few years, it's definitely something that we know that children are experiencing. We ask about those issues. We address it. I've actually called schools myself and spoken with principals and guidance counselors to address it at the school level. Sometimes parents have tried to get that issue addressed if a child is being bullied because of their weight. And the parents aren't being listened to. They'll listen to a doctor, I've found. Mm-hmm. Almost 100% of our patients, and we've done this with some surveys in our clinic, almost 100% of our patients in our obesity clinic have had experienced some sort of verbal bullying or teasing. So it's quite prevalent. And so it's something we take very seriously. We try to minimize.
Well, how does it work out in the Adobe Clinic? How do you address both the psychological concerns and also promote a healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, it takes time. All our new patients, we have an hour, and we usually go beyond that hour, so we oftentimes are running over. But a lot of that time is spent with questionnaires, and then we have a kind of a formal interview, medical interview that we do. And then we try to get our dietitians in very quickly with that first, at least, you know, with that first visit and consecutive visits after that. I want to just kind of promote kind of a new program that we have called the Tigers on Track program that was developed by actually a colleague of mine, Dr. Karen Chowdhury, and we've actually been able to add a physical therapy component as well as a mental health component, in addition to seeing a dietitian and the physician. So it's been a really nice multidisciplinary approach. And I'm sure Steve would agree that adding a physical therapy component is crucial if you're really trying to combat childhood obesity from all ends.
Sure.
And do you find that schools are sensitive to that, though, that they do view a multidimensional approach as being appropriate to combat obesity rates?
I think that's really the only way to do it. I think, it's to just focus on a medical issue or just a dietary issue or just an exercise issue. I think you might solve part of the problem, but, we know there's so many issues going on that leads a child to become overweight. That you really try to, if you don't try to address all those issues, you're probably going to fall short of your goal.
Okay. Well, we have a caller on the line. Brian from Columbia, are you there?
I am.
Okay, great. Thanks for calling in, Brian. Do you have a question or a comment?
I do. I'm hearing that whole grains are being endorsed. I'm wondering if any of your experts are aware of the research that's cited in Wheat Belly by Michael. I think Michael is the first name, but Dr. Davis. And one of the things he cites in that book is that 2 pieces of whole wheat toast will spike the blood sugar quicker and higher than a Snickers bar. I'm just wondering if they're aware of that research.
I am not.
Yeah, it's not something I'm familiar with either. So I hate to comment on something I've not read, but I think I want to know what the implications of that. So just because you have a short spike in blood sugar, does it? I would like to know what that does in terms of weight and other future risk factors. I'm not familiar with that study, so I really can't fairly comment on the caller's question.
I would highly encourage you to check that out, because that's just the tip of the iceberg as far as the research that's cited in that book. And the source, he says, is the genetic modification of wheat, which he says is completely different than ancient wheat, and that causes the genetic modification apparently has caused these findings, the research findings, that people that consume a lot of whole wheat, now he doesn't talk about other whole grains, but whole wheat, the modern whole wheat, is cited with very many health risks and detrimental factors. And he cites, as well as the clinical research, he cites his practice statistics of people that have gotten off wheat, that have lost weight, that have gotten a significant reduction, if not gotten rid of some of their medical conditions. So okay. It would behoove you, I think, to check that out.
All right. Thanks, Brian. There's some other areas we want to cover, so we'll have to let you go now. But just briefly, what was the name of that book again?
Wheat Belly.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for calling in today. Okay.
Can I just comment just briefly on that?
Sure.
I just, a lot of studies that are out there are done on adults, and I think since we're focusing on childhood obesity, I think it's very important to realize that what may be applicable to adults may or may not be applicable for children going through puberty and development and growth. And so I think I'd caution your audience to avoid using studies that were done on adults and then using that on children. I think moderation is the key. I agree. I mean, too much of anything, including wheat, would be a problem. And so I think we really focus on moderation. And I think if you can really focus on moderation, limit setting, I think that's where you'll be most successful, again, with childhood obesity.
Okay. Well, I guess going off of Brian's point, though, in talking with a lot of parents at the clinic, I mean, do they have similar, do they bring research to you in an effort to kind of get you to parse through it and explain it?
Oh, yeah.
How does that?
I get all sorts of stuff. And, it's good. I mean, to me, that's a good sign because it tells me that the parents are really interested and are wanting to participate in the healthcare decision-making process. And I appreciate that. But, again, I caution, if you find one study supporting something, then that probably is not something we're going to focus on. I think it's, again, we focus on moderation. What can we cut? We definitely know that too many calories in not enough calories out. That's going to be a recipe for weight gain. Mm-hmm. How can we cut some of those calories down? We try to individualize what we do, and so what we may recommend for one child may be different from another child from a different family.
Yeah, and I think you know, if you eliminate one food group, an entire food group, then you'll probably see you're going to be eating less calories most likely, and so you may have weight loss.
Okay. Well, and earlier in the show, we were talking about multidimensional approaches to address both psychological concerns and physical concerns. How does that play out with physical education, Steve?
Right. So there's a story behind physical education, and if you go back 50 or 60 years ago, Europe and other countries did fitness testing on their kids, and then the United States, we went and tested a small cohort of our kids, and we found out that our kids weren't as fit as their kids. So what did we do? We had a campaign to make all of our young folks fit, and so it's been a fitness model ever since. And you guys can remember back being in elementary school and physical education. You might remember taking some presidential tests, and you did that at the beginning of the semester, and then you had your PE course, right? And then you took those tests again, and we saw how much you improved. And this has been, knowingly or not, a way that physical educators have, bamboozled superintendents and principals and others to say, look how great my physical education program was because these kids improved on these different fitness measures. And unfortunately, young kids, especially young kids, don't have the physiology and the hormones to improve fitness very much. And the PE program is not going to make a kid's cardiovascular fitness improve significantly over a short period of time. And so why do kids do better on the test the second time they take them? They learned how to take the test, they got taller, they matured, and those types of things. And so this fitness model, and so what we've done is focused on fitness, and fitness is a product. It's something that you have, and genetics plays a role in it, right? So we test for cardiovascular fitness, and we test for muscular strength, and we test for flexibility and body composition, these types of things. Who does good on the mile run? Not the heavyweight. Heavy kid, right? It's harder. You've got more weight to carry around. They finish last. Other students are there watching. They're not usually encouraging. They're saying, come on, why are you walking? You can, you know, you should be running. Does that breed a love of physical activity to that kid? That's the kid we're worried about, mm-hmm. right? So high-intensity physical activity, which is required to achieve fitness, pushes more kids away than it does bring them into it. So I think, you know, the idea behind having all of our kids fit was great, but it hasn't worked. And we've got to promote the process of physical activity, not the product of fitness, because all kids can achieve it. It's just like if we went to our music teachers and said, I expect you to produce all great musicians, or our, you know, art teacher, I expect you to create a great artist. Genetics plays a role, so all kids can't be fit, and it hasn't worked. So what can we do? We need to focus on the process, and all kids can increase how much activity they're getting, but not all kids can be fit. So there's been too much emphasis on fitness, in my opinion, in physical education. So we need to focus more on the process of activity. And as I said earlier, we've got to get kids active before school, during school, improve PE after school and at home if we really want to make a difference. Because although moderation is great for diet when it comes to exercise, some is better than none, but more is better than some, and too much is really difficult to get. So we've got to figure out how can we get kids, provide them with the opportunity. The cool thing about kids is if you provide them an opportunity to be active, they generally will. So we've got to figure out how to do that. And the last thing I would say is it's unfair to say that kids aren't physically active. Lots of kids get lots of activity, and they're the most active segment of society. But the kids that aren't getting enough activity, those are the ones we're worried about.
Well, in terms of physical activity, Dr. Tosh, earlier you mentioned that reducing screen time is one of the goals that parents should pursue in encouraging healthy behavior. Do you see the video game consoles like the Wii or something that's activity based? Do you see that as a welcoming sign that that people might lead healthier lives? Or is it a useful technology, I guess?
But probably not. We have patients who ask about the Wii and all the other, like Kinect and all the other things where it might have a physical component. But typically the games are usually playing, though, are not those type of games that lead to significant calorie reduction or calorie burn. I've had some patients, though, who have been successful. They attribute a game system or game program, a video game, to some of their weight loss. So I don't count it out. But, you know, I think most of the time those video game units are used for playing games that are quite sedentary still. And so we just have to kind of look into it and see how much are they actually using it for activity, for exercise. I think the other issue that I kind of want to bring up related to screen time is the TV in the bedroom. And actually we did a survey, and at least of my patients, so most of our patients come from Columbia and mid-Missouri. 80% of our patients had so these are children and adolescents, have a TV in their bedroom, which is above the national average, which is about 60%. So something about being in mid-Missouri, it's must be the thing to do to have a TV in your bedroom. We know there's a lot of risk factors. Even if patients are normal weight, you know, you're basically exposing your child to advertising and potential viewing things that you may not want them to watch. But definitely we know that having a TV in the bedroom is correlated very strongly with being sedentary, not exercising, and also eating. And we know what they're eating is not the healthy stuff, eating while watching TV. So as much as we can minimize screen time, I think is the best. And getting the TV out of the bedroom is sometimes one of the things we talk about kind of go over with our parents our recommendations.
Okay. And Steve, it looked like you...
I would just comment also on the you know, the Wii and the Kinect and those types of things. We definitely shouldn't rule them out, and they can help kids get some activity, but it shouldn't be the main form, and it shouldn't replace normal play. So I think sometimes parents are taking that as, hey, this is what they're going to do for their physical activity. It's not enough.
Okay. I agree with that.
Well, I just want to remind listeners right now that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tongakar. Today we're talking about childhood obesity. I'm joined today by Dr. Anish Tosh and Kayla Audison from the University of Missouri Children's Hospital's Adolescent Diabetes and Obesity Program, also referred to by the acronym ADOBE. Also joining us is Steve Ball. He's an associate professor in the MU Department of Nutrition and Exercise Physiology. And we'd like to hear from you in our audience as well. For the parents in our audience, what do you do in order to limit your children's screen time? Send us your suggestions. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Well, Steve, are there any other technologies that could be used with either in the home or in school to encourage increased physical activity?
One of the things, and I brought one today, I know the viewers won't be, or the listeners won't be able to see it, but it's a pedometer, and it's just a little device that we've had some good success with in young kids. And so all kids, as I mentioned, can increase physical activity. So what we do with the pedometers is determine baseline step counts. So the kids are tracking how much activity they're getting during the school day, and then during PE, and then sometimes we even check them out, so they're getting 24-hour data. But then they try to increase by 10 to 20% over 2-week periods. So we don't use a one goal fits all model, because as I mentioned, lots of kids are getting lots of activity, and some kids are not getting near enough. And if you have the same goal for some kids, it's way, way too high, and other kids are already reaching it. So what you do is you individualize it, and they focus on the process of physical activity. And so these are a fairly inexpensive tool that we use in schools, but parents can use them, and it can be a family thing. Kids seem to be very interested in using them after the novelty phase wears off. And we've been lucky enough in one of our programs, Jump Into Action, we've reached over 50,000 fifth graders, and we've purchased pedometers for over 50,000 kids. And so we're pretty proud of that statistic. But pedometers were a big part of that program. And one of the things that we fight with schools is getting into the schools. And there's often pushback because teachers are required to increase academic scores on tests, and the last thing they want to hear about is worrying about putting a pedometer on a fourth grader and tracking step counts, right? So we now have a strong body of literature that supports physical activity and better academic scores. So if kids spend more time, whether it's during recess being physically active, if we increase PE time, intramurals, whatever it is, kids do better academically. And so there's an acute effect, and there seems to be a long-term effect as well. So there's something happening in the brain. But I just say, hey, they're better learners. You know, my college students can't sit still for 45 minutes. You know, you expect a fourth or fifth grader to sit there all day and be quiet.
Well, we've talked about, you know, increasing physical activity and limiting and eating healthier. I guess I know families don't have to choose between one or the other, but is there between the two, is there one that's more effective in terms of targeting and reducing obesity rates?
I would just say you can definitely out-eat your exercise.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I was glad you spoke first, because I know the exercise part is extremely important. Again, there's been evidence supporting that. Again, those sugared beverages, we really want everything. I mean, I think, you know, diet and exercise being focused on, but the one key intervention that we found successful, at least in our clinic, if they can reduce their sugared beverages, those are the patients that we're seeing either stop their weight gain or even start losing weight. Then we work on the other things. And again, I'm not trying to downplay the exercise, because of course we really focus on the exercise part as well. Can I say something about the pedometers? We've actually started giving out two pedometers. We used to just give one out to our patients. And when we saw them back in follow-up, we asked them how the pedometers went, and the kid would say, I don't know, because my mom took it. And so it was great. Actually, I was very encouraged by that, because at least someone in the family was taking interest in using the pedometer. And so we actually started giving out two, so one for the patient, one for the parent. And so that's great, because now we have, again, the family dynamic is so important, and so we got the kid and the parent involved. So I said, let's give two out when we give these out. I want to emphasize the exercise part, but it does seem that, as Steve says, it's just so easy to consume so many calories in a short period of time that focusing on what you're eating and drinking is probably a good place to start. That's typically what we do, and that's where we found the most success.
Okay. Well, I guess going off that point, though, are there any other similar success stories at the Adobe Clinic that illustrate, interventions that worked well and maybe can help parents figure out what they could do?
You know, I don't want to take any credit, because I think we just give them the information and we just hope our families, something sticks. So none of this is something that's due to us or me. I had a patient who was quite overweight, and he was, I think, 14 or 15 years old, and had a pretty severe asthma. And we do know that actually obesity and asthma are related, and that weight loss or weight reduction can help reduce worsening asthma. And so this patient, hopefully with some information that we gave him, but he kind of took it on his own and just got very interested in diet and exercise, got very involved in fitness, and lost a significant amount of weight, and actually is now a personal trainer. And his asthma, he's off almost all his asthma medications, and I still see him, and, you know, to me, he is a great example, and I use his example when I talk to other families as well, of how you can almost, you know, not only improve the weight issues and the risk for diabetes, but also other health issues can be improved as well, including this person's asthma, by just working on fitness. He just got really into it, and he's still very active. And again, now is using his experience as an overweight child, and actually, I think actually that gives him more buy-in when he's talking to people that he's working with as a physical personal trainer, and using his experience to help other people now. I think it's just been great.
Wow.
That's fabulous.
Well, we have another question from our chat room with regards to sugared beverages. Would you recommend consuming diet drinks as an alternative to sugar drinks?
I typically say I would rather it be diet than regular sugar. So that's kind of my first rule. That being said, I still think soda is a treat, whether it's diet or regular. So that's what I encourage, to even if it's diet, to still keep it as a treat. I think there are lots of studies that have proved that they're safe. That's what I tell the families I see. And also I push water as well and encourage water consumption.
The only things a child or adolescent should be drinking are water and milk. But you tell that to families and they just, you know, they want to slap you because that's pretty boring. We're realistic. I mean, you have to live in the real world, and, you know, and also as healthcare providers, we have to do that as well. I mean, we know that our patients are drinking more than just water and skim milk. And so I do think that using, if you could use diet soda as a bridge, there is some evidence, and I'm sure some of your audience is familiar with this, that perhaps drinking diet soda may lead to actual increase in other types of snacking that we're still trying to sort out. The evidence is not clear. There is some evidence out there, but there's also some evidence refuting that. But we're just trying to work on ways to reduce calories. Mm-hmm. And so if we can use diet soda as a bridge, I've had a lot of patients with interest in flavored water, and so that's become more popular, and I think that's great. And so, however we can start working towards the healthier goals, we're in favor of. So we do the best we can, I think, is kind of what we try to do in clinic.
Okay. Well, in preparing for this show today, one idea that came up was the idea of using certain junk foods and only allowing kids to consume them during periods of celebration. Is that a useful tactic to actually let kids eat, say, pizza at like a party, or is it, or maybe sugared beverages? That might be a better example, to consume beverages at a party as opposed to a complete ban.
I mean, I think those foods will always be around for celebrations for the rest of their lives, and holidays. So if you can learn to moderation even for those special occasions, I think that's fine. I think treats have their place and can be in a healthy diet.
Okay. And see if it looks
like... I was just going to say, one of the things that we've done in schools that's been quite successful is try to limit unhealthy celebratory foods. So I think it's on average like 40 times a year that for birthdays and Easter and Halloween that parents will bring in cupcakes and cookies and different things. And so we send home literature on about here are some healthy options that you might bring in instead of cookies. Okay. To try to limit those unhealthy things that are in schools.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, I was gonna say, the celebrations add up.
Yeah, they do.
And so it's not like it's once in a while. It's sometimes it's several times in a week. You know, if several kids are in Little League and you go out each night with a different child's team, so the celebrations add up. Try to limit as much you can is kind of our recommendation.
Okay, and we have less than a minute left, but. One thing we didn't really address is the issue of ensuring that kids get enough sleep and how that correlates to obesity. I guess, how many hours would you recommend that children sleep?
They're probably not getting enough, and the topic of sleep is a whole other issue. You probably don't have enough time. Probably for adolescents, which is my area of focus, is at least 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night. And we know that by nighttime snacking, caffeinated beverages, video games, all of those interrupt sleep. They're probably not getting enough sleep. And again, by reducing some of those risk factors, they improve their sleep and improve their function at school the next day.
Okay, and we have about 20 seconds left. But if parents have additional questions, are there any resources that you can direct them to?
We have a website called MissouriFamilies.org, and there's lots of good information on there about health and physical activity and nutrition.
Okay, and where can people find more information about the Adobe program?
Sure. It's on the University of Missouri Children's Hospital website. And if any patients are interested in the Tigers on Track program, the phone number is 573-882-6979.
Okay, and we'll have to leave it at that. That's it for today's Intersection. Thank you to our guests. Dr. Anish Tosh is the director of the Adolescent Diabetes and Obesity Program at the University of Missouri Children's Hospital. Kayla Otteson is a dietitian that also works for the same program. Steve Ball is an associate professor in the MU Department of Nutrition and Exercise Physiology, and he also is a state fitness specialist with MU Extension. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our show each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of KBIA and RJI. Today's episode was produced by Ryan Mueliner and Brinita Rizvik, with production assistance from Katie Moritz. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.